For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Very happy to have our Eno, Kevin, be here this evening for Sangha Talk. Kevin, please.
Thank you. Good evening.
When Tygon asked me to give the Sangha Talk tonight, I immediately started thinking about what I was going to talk about, and went through a number of different topics in my head. In the talks that I've given in the past, I've tended to focus on sort of the interaction of my practice with my kids, because I'm the father of two small children, and that's a big part of my life. And so for tonight, I also wanted to talk about something that was sort of top of mind for me recently, and as I started thinking through it, it's something that's kind of come up a lot during my practice. And so as I was thinking about this topic, the title that was sort of forming in my head as I thought more about it was Hacking Zazen. And the alternate title that I had come up with was How to Become a Zazen Hacker. So before I go into that in any detail, I want to talk a little bit about what I mean by that, because I think those words have some distinct connotation, especially in popular culture today. So by my occupation and kind of inclination, I'm someone who really enjoys technology. I love computers, I love gadgets. I love playing with the coolest new things that come out. I have an engineering degree, so it's something that I take very deeply. And basically throughout my entire career, professional career, I've always worked with computers and technology. So it's something I find very comfortable. I remember my very first computer, an Apple II Plus, if you're curious. And I remember every computer that I've ever had since then, either purchased or built. Much to the amazement of my wife whenever I go through the litany. I don't know if it's amazement or concern, but I'll go with the amazement side. So I really love dealing with technical challenges. I like finding new ways to solve problems. And my idea of a relaxing evening often is potentially upgrading a piece of software on one of our computers, or figuring out how to use a piece of software to do something new that I had never been able to do with it before. So I think people like me tend to have a lot of names in our culture, but I'll go with the term geek. And within the context of the geek community, the term hacker has a very different meaning than what most people probably would think of. So from the New Hacker's Dictionary, which is available on the internet, if you want to Google it, there's this definition. Hacker, noun. Originally, someone who makes furniture with an axe. Alternate definition one. A person who enjoys exploring the details of programmable systems and how to stretch their capabilities, as opposed to most users who prefer to learn only the minimum necessary. Definition two. An expert or enthusiast of any kind. One might be an astronomy hacker, for example. Definition three. One who enjoys the intellectual challenge of creatively overcoming or circumventing limitations. So these are the definitions of the word hacker that I was thinking of as I was coming up with this this talk and really the title. And the kind of the things that stick out in my mind, at least, are, you know, stretching our capabilities instead of learning only the minimum necessary, an enthusiast of any kind, creatively overcoming limitations. So to go a little bit further into that, I got to get a little more autobiographical. My own first exposure to Zen was when I was in college. And I got involved with a small informal sitting group that met near campus. The group met every Thursday night in a room at a local church, and it was very, very low-key. So we didn't have cushions, we didn't have an altar, we didn't really have much of anything other than a group of people who every Thursday night came in, sat around facing the wall. You know, our meeting started basically everyone kind of quietly coming, finding a spot. The bell rang. 40 minutes later, the bell rang again. Everybody got up. We sat in a circle in the middle of the room. And then one of the people in our group would read a chapter from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. We'd talk a little bit about what we thought that meant. Then we'd straighten up the room and go home. By my senior year in college, I had become a fairly regular attendee of the group. And the gentleman who organized our group, who was a retired English professor, mentioned to me that if I really wanted to see what Zen had to show me, I might want to consider going to a sesshin or a retreat. And that he had been a fairly regular attendee at one that was organized by the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, and gave me some information in a brochure about their yearly 7-day sesshin in June at the retreat center, which is called Hokioji, which is located just near the border between Iowa and Minnesota. So I had some time between graduation and starting my job. And I'd also been sort of curious about what this thing that I had been doing every Thursday night was really going to be. Was it something that I was going to continue? Was it sort of a phase? The whole kind of seeing what it was going to show me was sort of entertaining. So I said, you know what, I'm going to try this. I have the time. And so I signed up for a 7-day sesshin at Hokioji. And the schedule for the sesshin started with everybody arriving on a Friday afternoon. There was some time to set up your tent because we were all sleeping outside. And then there was an informal dinner and a brief chance to meet everybody. And then also about a 20-minute introduction to this thing called Orioki, which I wasn't really sure what that was, but I didn't know what it was, so I went. And then everybody filed into the Zendo, and we started the sesshin with a period of meditation and silence from that point on. So for someone who was used to a very simplified version of Zen, I was completely overwhelmed by the middle of the next morning. So this not only was my first exposure to extended multiple periods of Zazen, there was also this whole Zen ceremony thing that I didn't know what it was. It seemed like there wasn't a single thing that we did during the entire day or night that didn't have some ceremony around it that I had no idea what was going on. And no one was talking, so I was basically figuring everything out by watching. And everything from getting into the Zendo, eating my food, leaving the Zendo, going to the bathroom had a ceremony related to it. So this was all new to me, and I was trying to pick it up, you know, as I mentioned, by watching everybody around me. The sesshin was actually led by a Zen priest named Shohaku Akamura. And Shohaku's Dharma talk theme for that week, sort of unbeknownst to me, but the one that he had picked was the chant that we just did, Fukan Zazengi. So by the time of that first Dharma talk in the morning, when I was just about at my completely overwhelmed phase, we were chanting Fukan Zazengi, which was my first experience with it, and I came across these words. At your sitting place, spread out a thick mat and put a cushion on it. Sit either in the full lotus or half lotus positions. In the full lotus position, first place your right foot on your left thigh, then your left foot on your right thigh. In the half lotus, simply place your left foot on your right thigh. Tie your robes loosely and arrange them neatly. Then place your right hand on your left leg and your left hand on your right palm, thumbs tips lightly touching. Straighten your body and sit upright, leaning neither left nor right, neither forward nor backward. Align your ears with your shoulders and your nose with your navel. Rest the tip of your tongue against the front of the roof of your mouth, with teeth and lips together both shut. Always keep your eyes open and breathe softly through your nose. Once you have adjusted your posture, take a breath and exhale fully. Rock your body right and left, settle into steady, immovable sitting. So, for me at least, and particularly at this time, this was sort of like a beacon of light shining out. It was clear and easy to understand instructions. It was language that I really understood, and it made sense without any explanation. And it was also very pertinent to what I was experiencing at the time, having, you know, not really sat in any extended periods of time before. And I think the other thing that, as I've thought back on this period many times since, in some regards, and especially as I've gotten exposure to more of Dogen's writings, it still amazes me, you know, to go back to my previous geek example. I mean, it's somewhat around the nature of someone from the 1940s writing a tip on how to use your iPod or your iPhone today. I mean, it's like someone from the 1200s writing something that just, you know, it makes sense. And there are a lot of things, obviously, in Zen that we talk about that are very deep and very, at least for me, difficult to wrap my head around. But this sort of showed me something else, in particular with you know, at the time and as I've gone back to it, that there's maybe not another side, but there's another aspect of this practice that is very practical, that is very, you know, not necessarily deep, but things like, how do I sit regularly? How do I develop a regular practice? You know, what happens when my leg falls asleep? What do I do if I fall asleep? All of these different things that I guess in my head fall into this concept of learning how to hack Zazen. So, you know, as I started thinking about this, I was thinking about a number of different things that I've learned since that time until now. And, you know, looking at them, none of them are earth-shattering revelations. None of them are the secret sauce that you find behind the closed door. But at least for me, these were all things that I've sort of stumbled upon or, you know, with Taigen's help, gotten suggestions on. And as I was preparing for this talk, I started asking myself, what are a few of the things that I wish that I had known when I had started? And so that's what I wanted to share a little bit with everyone tonight, at least to hopefully kind of further explain or demonstrate, I guess, what I mean when I say hacking Zazen. So the first theme was sit with others. And I don't mean this in, I think, sometimes the broader philosophical sense that Taigen sometimes brings up, where, you know, he's made the statement before that you can never sit by yourself, which when I first hear that, I'm like, well, of course I can go in my room, I can sit by myself. And as you explain it, it makes total sense. And I think in some regards that feeds into this. But what I'm even talking about is even less, I guess, philosophical than that. And that is that in my experience, it is very important to find a group of people that you sit with on a regular basis. And I think there's something about that's very deep that I can't wrap my head around. But I think there's also something very practical about it. Just in terms of encouraging all of our practice. After that first session, and I had made it through all 7 days, much to my own amazement, if nobody else's, when I left, I had this just enormous amount of energy, and I was just like, God, I've done everything, and I'm like totally pumped, and I'm gonna like sit Zazen for the rest of my life, and I figured it out, and this is awesome. And it actually sort of worked for about 2 months, I would say. I was pretty good every day, you know, did it. And then after about 2 months, I don't know if it was the special glow wore off or reality set in or what it was. But, you know, after about 6 months, I would say, I found that I was hardly sitting at all. And, you know, I was kind of like, well, wait a minute. I remember when I went through this whole experience that this was, you know, I thought I figured it out. And since then, I've had several other kind of lulls and dips in my practice. And what I've found is when I have a group of people that I sit with regularly, it helps me even it out. And it helps me keep up a regular practice. And it helps me keep up that energy that by myself I can't seem to do. There are all these great stories in Zen about people like Bodhidharma that can go off into a mountain cave for 9 years and... what I've realized is I'm definitely not Bodhidharma, and there may other be people like me, and so that's why places like Dragon and finding a group that you can sit with on a regular basis is so important. Excuse me. So the second theme of things as I was thinking through this was sitting regularly. So again, not rocket science. But there's a lot of different things that kind of fall into this category for me, at least, that I've learned over the years. And the first was basically that sitting on demand didn't really work that well. So when I was first starting to sit on my own, and even after, I often tried to approach my practices, I'll either sit when I need to, which is in and of itself an interesting concept, or I'd sit when I had time. So it would be like, oh yeah, I'm going to sit today, but yeah, I'll do that later. Like, I'll do that this afternoon, or I'm going to sit after I get back from work, or no, tomorrow I'll sit in the morning and I'll take care of that. And what I found was that my mind and my life were very good at conspiring about making up ways for me not to do that. And so what I found was as I had the best of intentions, they never seemed to come true. And so I started shifting my thinking to, instead of thinking of that I would sit on demand, and to try and start thinking of it similar to brushing my teeth or taking a shower. It's just what I do at that time. It's part of the schedule. And what I found was that actually allowed me to get a regular sitting practice, and I found that as I did that more, the regularity of it built on itself. And one of the things that I found most useful as I was going through this was something that Tygen said to me when we first started, when I first met him actually, and did my first Dokusan with him, and I've heard you say this to others as well. And it was basically that when, you know, a regular practice doesn't necessarily mean that you sit every day. And maybe think about trying to sit 5 times a week. Or if that doesn't work, try and sit 3 times a week. But set some goal or some number and aim for that. And that was actually, as silly as this may sound, that was actually somewhat revolutionary to me at the time, because I was like, oh, I kept thinking that if I wasn't sitting every day, that wasn't going to work. And this concept that I could actually scale it back a little bit and think, oh, maybe I'll just try and do 5 times. That was very helpful. And I've actually sort of extended that a little bit on my own, kind of weaving with my high school experiences in high school track, which is, I guess, a little Zazen interval training, where I found that if I don't sit for a while, I might actually need to ratchet down my goals even less. And so I'll say, like, for example, after my son was born, my wife and I's first child, there was a period of about 3 months where I didn't sleep, so sitting was sort of off the agenda too. And when things settled down a little bit, I set a goal for myself. I'm going to sit 2 times over the next 2 weeks. And when I was able to do that, it was, okay, now I'm going to sit 3 times over the next 2 weeks, and then I'm going to sit 4 times. And the next thing I knew it, I was up to 5 times a week. And it didn't really seem to be that big hill that I've experienced in the past. In addition to just sitting regularly, I mentioned a little bit about sitting on demand not working so well. And what I found was that sitting at the same time, and not just at set times, but the same time every day, is really useful. So before I had children, there was a number of options during the day, and I could say, okay, I'm just going to sit every day when I get home from work, or whatever that might be. And once I had children, I realized that my options were even further constrained to either before they got up or after they went to bed. And by my own nature, I'm not a huge night owl. And what I found was that sitting after they went to bed, I was either usually too tired or something else cropped up in my life that sort of didn't work out from a sitting perspective. So I was really sort of, whether by my own intention or not, sort of forced into this question of the mornings are the only time you can sit, and if you want to have a regular sitting practice, you're going to have to get up in the morning before the kids do. And so that presented me with a number of different problems, particularly around the question of how do I become a morning person? Because at that point, I was not a morning person. And the idea of getting up every day at 5:15 or 5:30 if I absolutely didn't have to was a little painful. And so I spent some time looking around and talking to people. And here are a couple things that I found out about becoming a morning person, which others may already know, but for me were pretty valuable. The first thing was getting up at the same time every day. And so when I got started with this, that actually meant the same time all 7 days of the week, which my wife initially thought I was crazy because why I was setting my alarm on Saturday and Sunday. But it made a huge difference to resetting my kind of internal clock and really allowing myself to get up at 5:15 and not be just in a complete fog for a half an hour. The next thing that I found that worked really well, which still is a little surprising to me, but I've tested this out many times and it does work, is before I go to bed, one of the last things I do before I turn out the light is silently to myself, I say, I'm getting up at 5:15 tomorrow morning. And then I go to sleep. And for whatever reason, it allows me to actually half the time pretty much wake up right before my alarm does. But even when the alarm does go off, I'm a lot more awake and aware than I am if I don't tell myself that. And the chances of me accidentally hitting the Zoom or sleep button are much lower. And then the last tip that I've found that actually works really well as well is I always leave a glass of water next to my bed before I go to bed. And when my alarm goes off and I swing my feet over the bed, first thing I do is pick up that glass of water and I drink at least half of it. And there's something about your body getting that much water, you know, or something that wakes you up. And it sounds kind of crazy because there's no caffeine in it and it's not coffee. But for me, at least, it works really well. So between those three things, I've actually learned how to train myself to become a morning person and be able to take advantage of that time. And then the last thing I would say related to regular sitting, again, somewhat common sense, but it took me a little while to figure this out, was finding a dedicated space where I sit every day. And so, and by this, I don't mean necessarily that you have a dedicated room, although if you have that ability, I'm sure that's great. But just some place that's, I always know that that's where my cushion is and that I don't have to pull something out of a closet and set anything up and do anything. So for me, that's a corner in our living room where I just have my cushion. It's kind of out of the way. And when I get up in the morning, the only thing I have to do is unfold my Zabutan, put my Rakusu on, and I sit. And that actually makes a big difference, especially when it's early in the morning and you're sort of half in a fog anyways. So the last group of stuff that was sort of floating in my head as I was thinking about this, I've sort of grouped under the title, You Don't Have to Sit to Be Mindful. And so, you know, a lot of the books that I have read and encountered on Zen, you know, talk a lot about mindfulness in everything we do, and that Zen is not just a sitting exercise. And in fact, in the Fukan Zazengi, Dogen mentions that as well. And so, you know, I've always sort of equated that as be mindful in all things. And it's like, yeah, okay, check. Yep, that sounds easy. Can do that, sure. And in practice, I've found, as others may have as well, this to be anything but easy. You know, Taigen often talks about our modern culture and how easy it is to get distracted by the myriad things. And I've absolutely found that to be the case for me as well. And I think, you know, one of the things that was another sort of revelation, might be too strong, but was certainly something that took me a little while to come to grips with, was even with a regular sitting practice, that's a small slice of my day, and I spend large swaths of it out in the world doing other things than sitting and meditating. But there's something about finding ways to bring mindfulness or to bring attention to what you're doing into those settings as well. And so that, you know, Taigen and I have talked about this a lot over the years, and I've also stumbled on different things either through variations on suggestions that he's made or other things that I've read. And so I just wanted to share a couple of those with everyone here. And most of mine actually tend to revolve around an office setting because I work in an office, and so that's where I end up spending a large chunk of my time. And it's also, for me at least, a place that I find one of the most challenging to try and keep mindfulness in any period of time. So, you know, if it's not email or IM or phone or people walking by or, you know, things that you have to do, there's a lot of different things that are pulling at attention. So a couple things that I found to be helpful. The first is having a mindful object at your desk. So for me, this is, I guess, a little embarrassing, but it's basically a little plastic hippopotamus dressed as Obi-Wan Kenobi that my brother gave me from some trip he was in Germany. It's on my desk, so I keep the hippopotamus's name is Obi-Wan Hippobi. So Obi-Wan sits under my desktop monitor, and as I'm going about my day and doing different things, when my eyes kind of wander by Obi-Wan, I just take a breath. And sometimes when I come back to my desk and I'm either really stressed out or I really just need a little bit of break, I might just spend some time hanging out watching, just staring at Obi-Wan for a while. It's not necessarily conspicuous because I have a lot of other random things on my desk, so nobody would look at it and say, you know, that's... I don't have a giant statue of Buddha on my desk or anything like that. I just have my little plastic hippopotamus. But I found that it's really helpful. The other thing that I found, and I've read this in other places too, and particularly for someone like myself who's not particularly clean with my desk. I mean, there's always stuff, and you know, the day goes by, and different papers and other kind of stuff. But I always keep the space around Obi-Wan clean, and that's sort of that's my clean space. And everywhere else on my desk can get messy and can get crazy, but that's a spot that I keep clean. Another thing that I found very helpful is mindful walking in the office. So this is not like Kinyan, so I'm again not trying to draw attention to myself, but what I found is that if I set a certain route, so we have kind of a circular layout in my office, so this is maybe easier for me than most. But if there's a time that I need to get a little break or focus and I don't have time to go outside or I can't for whatever reason, I'll just take a lap around the office. And it's a very set path, so I don't have to think about where I'm going, and I can sort of focus on what I'm doing with my breath and that, which I find very similar to what we do when we do Kinyan. But I find that very useful. And then the last thing, particular to this, that I found useful is, and I struggle to come up with a better term for this, but at least in my head I've always called this sort of breath points in my office. So there are corners or... at times I've picked different pictures or things that we'll have in our office that for that week I'll just say every time I walk by this particular thing, I'm going to take a deep breath and pay attention to my breath. So all of those I've found to be very useful for me. And it's certainly not to say that I spend all of my day being mindful or that is radical, but I do find that it's very helpful for me at least to sort of bring my practice from the morning into my day. The other area that I've kind of explored with and played around with is the other big chunk of time that I spend in my day, which is basically commuting. So I'm able to take the train commuting, but basically between the commute in and commute out, I spend a good chunk of time in the morning and the afternoon. And so a couple things that I found useful related to that. One is mindful walking between my office and the train. Again, not anything particularly noticeable, but I just sort of, as I'm leaving the office, say to myself, you know, this is going to be a mindful walk to the train. And I'll pay attention to my breathing. I'll pay attention to what's going around me, stuff that I normally would walk by and not really see. I've also played around a fair amount with actually meditating on the train. And this is actually something that, when I first started thinking about it, didn't really seem like it would be that big of a deal or difficult, but I've actually found it to be a little bit challenging. A couple of things. One is, I've noticed that if you actually take some of the postures or do some of the things that we would normally do in meditation, people react to you slightly strangely. So I don't know if they don't know what's going on. Or so, you know, finding ways to sort of stay... in a mindful posture, but not really make it look like you're in a mindful posture is an interesting exercise I would encourage people to try. I've found that closing my eyes, even though I know we don't try and do that, oftentimes people think you're asleep. So they don't, you know, the fact that you're sitting there not doing anything and staring straight ahead doesn't really seem to bother them as much as it does if your eyes are open. I've also found that putting in headphones, even not turning anything on, but just putting in your headphones, people assume you're listening to who knows what. So the fact that your eyes are open and you're staring down actually works pretty well. And the headphone thing actually works really well, especially for the times if you don't have a book or you're not with your headphones. Sometimes people will want to talk to you, which is potentially disruptive when you're trying to meditate. So you put the headphones in and they just kind of get you in a little zone of silence. So these are just some examples, and I'm sure there are many others, but these are just ones that I kind of wanted to share. And I, you know, as I thought about this and what I wanted to talk about, I guess for me, kind of going back to what I said at the beginning, this all is something that I've thought about at various times, and especially as I've dealt with different things about my practice, integrating my practice into my life, and the idea that there's a lot of different levels, I guess, in the way I think about to our Zen practice and what we do, and that sometimes paying attention to the lower level might be the wrong term, but the sort of the tips and tricks and the base level stuff can actually be very useful. And not something that, you know, maybe we always think about, or certainly that are written in lofty poems or sutras, except for, I guess, some from Dogen, at least the ones that I found. So I hope some of this was useful, and I would love to hear people's thoughts.
Thank you, Kevin. Very practical, down-to-earth, useful responses, comments, questions for Kevin.
Because I practice Kirlin Buddhism, we chant Amitabha Buddha. Mm-hmm. It's like one of the Buddhas. So often, like a lot of times, I'll be with my beads and I'll be chanting on the bus, and that's one advantage of that form of practice. Is you kind of do it everywhere because it's like very portable. I mean, you can be laying down, you can sit casually. It's not as important to be like sitting in a certain posture when you're doing it. You just sort of chat, and it kind of makes you mindful of Buddha and, you know, Buddha's inner nature. So that's it. And yet at the same time, I mean, there's two aspects to it. Like Buddha isn't like Amitabha isn't something external to you, but yet at the same time, something also internal to you. There's like both sides of it, form and non-form.
Mm-hmm.
Side. But yeah, just as a more portable practice. I mean, like, that's something people could take up some sort of mantra practice. There's many Buddhist mantras, for instance, that one could utilize to have, practice in those kind of times, like when commuting or sort of like in between transition times like that, standing in a line somewhere.
Yeah, no, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
I actually think of Zazen like that because we emphasize our sitting practice and the formal practice in the Zendo, but even here we have a variety of postures that are acceptable. Sitting in a chair, kneeling, cross-legged. I've done sesshin standing at times, and anyway, so there's something about Zazen that's also quite portable, but I like the mindfulness of Buddha, which is the heart of Nembutsu, or chanting the name of Amida Buddha, or using mantras, which I've recommended at times in Zazen or outside Zazen. I use them too. And like your Obi-Wan Kenobi hippopotamus, you know, anything that reminds us of Buddha brings us back to presence and awareness. It can be helpful in any part of our daily life.
Kevin, that was wonderful. I liked that a lot. I'm working with still finding the time.
to sit. And I am always too tired. And I do, I'm like, well, I'll do it later, you know? And I do that, and then I'm always too tired when Anne-Marie goes to bed, you know? But I'm still like, oh, getting up earlier would just be brutal. So I appreciate those tips on how, because I've always been curious, so I'm kind of have to work on being a morning person.
If you do a Google search on becoming a morning person, you'd be surprised at the amount of... I mean, there's actually this whole sort of culture that's sprung up, I think, in the last 4 or 5 years about, there's sites called Life Hacker, and there's actually one called Zen Tips, which doesn't really have anything to do with Zen, but basically these communities where people trade, like, okay, how do you become a morning person? And everybody throws in their ideas, and then they kind of sort out the best, you know, top 10 or whatever. It's interesting, but yeah, so there's a lot more than even the stuff that I talked about. Those were the ones that I found useful to me, but I'm sure there's others.
Well, it is helpful, and I guess one more thing for me was that I learned when I was first learning about Buddhism, and my dad, I think, practices, or he's more into Pure Land, but the mani prayer, or the mani.
Om mani padme hum.
Yeah, and that helps me when I'm driving. When I'm driving, I get into that, or when I have a sick child, either in one of the babies, or if Anne-Marie's really upset. And when I say it out loud to bring myself back to patience, mm-hmm. and being mindful, but also just that against them is very calming to them as well. And so that's been really helpful for me to do that, even though that's not necessarily part of this practice that I do. But it is, you know, it is. So that's really helpful for me. But I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Actually, I have a couple suggestions and then actually maybe a question. So the one book that comes to mind that I have is called The Dragon Who Never Sleeps by Ramanujan. And it's a bunch of small, like, almost prayers, very, like, mundane, I guess you could call them, things like entering the doorway, or changing the baby's diaper. I found a couple in there that I kind of morphed for my daily life at work. Then another thing that we used to do, which reminds me of your breath points, we did at the Zen Center. We had a practice called Every Minute Zen, where for 2 weeks, and we did it through the Roshi, so he would say, every time you unlock a door, you're going to breathe. Every time you look in the mirror. And they got steadily harder and harder. but that's kind of I think it's kind of hard to do that without a teacher, but maybe if you're more disciplined than me, you could try that. And then something I found that's really hard for me is if I drink alcohol at all, even like a beer, I can't get up. And I have a girlfriend who's an artist and not a Buddhist, and she's very, like, the culture is very, you get together and you drink, and even if I just have one or two beers, it's like my whole next day for sitting is shot. So I don't know if anyone has any suggestions. There's a couple people that I feel like they can go to a party and just have water, and I can't seem to be able to do that. So if anyone has any suggestions for that.
Are you able to sit later that next day, or just
the morning? Yeah, it's like the next morning, and then like the early morning afternoon, and then maybe I'm tired.
Yeah,
and
everything else takes over.
The same thing, you put it off. I used to be a morning person, and now I'm not anymore.
So maybe you're the one I got my morning person from.
Yeah,
thank you very much, Kevin Song. I'm always impressed that with your busy family life, that you can practice so deeply. And I think that your words are extremely wise, that, you know, we're all hacking together this practice in America, you know, in 13th century Japan, you know, 6th century BC India. But we've got to find a way to put our earphones on. Do our salsa, or pay attention to our breath. And I too have like this you know, OCD office where I've got two offices, so it's loaded with dharmic reminders because I find it so easy to forget what I'm doing. So I really appreciate that, using the breath, something really important. I think getting up every day is, you know, first thing in the morning, zazen is a pretty nice thing. Changes the whole scenery.
Yeah, it really does.
So how did you do that, like, with Grace? You know, we had a new baby fairly recently.
Yeah.
Did she sleep on a schedule?
I sort of figured out that she would wake up between certain periods, and then I reset my, I have to get up by this period, to 20 to 30 minutes before then. And so what I found, I mean, the timing would shift. So depending on when my daughter gets up, I may get up or I may sit less than other days, just because her timing would be different. Although recently in the last 2 months, I'll get her up, like if it's in the middle of sitting, I'll get her up, give her a bottle, and then I go and sit down, and she often will come and sit with me. I think she likes to just sit and drink her bottle and hang out. And in the last 2 weeks, I think she thinks I'm supposed to be reading, because she's now gotten in the habit of, when she's done with her bottle, she'll put it down and then go to the bookshelf and grab a book and hand me a book and then walk off into the kitchen, because I think she's just wondering what I'm doing kind of in the corner.
How old is she now?
She'll be 2 in January.
So she already knows you're wasting time.
She's Sunday, yeah. Because she often sits in my lap when we read stories, so I think that maybe, I don't know, she's making connections.
You know, one of the best advice I also got very early in practice was, if you want to do this practice, you have to arrange your life to be able to do it. And I think what that means changes depending on our life situations, but I really appreciate your study of your life and, you know, very deliberately and carefully, like, oh, okay. I mean, I know when I do intensive retreats, I sort of have this, like, system, you know, so, like, the minute the bell rings, or before the bell rings, I'm up, I've made my tea the night before, you know, like, there's this whole kind of, like, just there's this momentum. And it's true in my daily life, the way I kind of have my house and everything set up, it's just sort of like, okay, practice. There we are. And I think that's, but that sense of really intentionally, kind of, it doesn't happen magically. You know, even everything in the sendo and everything in our space, you know, is all sort of pointing towards, hello, zazen. Hello, world, you know.
Sometimes, I'm sorry.
Oh, I just wanted to go back to Josh's question, because I had a couple of responses, and maybe neither of them is very helpful, but for whatever it's worth. One is just, you know, I'm sometimes also in a situation with people where people are drinking, and sometimes I will, and sometimes, you know, if you have a drink that, you know, that's not alcoholic, that you can order, that you enjoy, then you might feel like, okay, I'm having a drink too, and
that's what I do.
Yeah, you could. So, you know, think about what kind of you know, some kind of soda or some kind of non-alcoholic drink that's really a particular thing that you could have in those situations. That's one suggestion which may or may not be helpful. The other one, which may also not be helpful, is to be flexible about your standards. So if you have a beer the night before and you wake up, and I think this is maybe a part of, you know, related to the kinds of suggestions you were making, Kevin, is that if we have some idea or standard of what our zazen should be, then we may feel like, oh, well, this isn't really zazen. I've found, my own experience is that I found it very helpful to have sometimes sleepy or groggy zazen, to still be present, to be upright, to be there facing the wall. So even if you get up in the morning and you have had a beer or two and you feel like your mind is all gummed up and hazy, still there's something, and it takes a little while to get that, but there's something about just assuming the position and facing the wall for X amount of minutes that allows you a wider sense of zazen in yourself. So that's the other response. So again, I don't know that either of them are helpful. But. Buddhist.
Well, I was going to say that, like other people, sometimes when you're just exhausted at night, you plan to sit. It's kind of daunting to say I'm going to sit for a whole period. If you just find you can't face that, then something that I find works lots of times is just say, okay, just put your butt on the cushion for 5 minutes. And 5 minutes will help the keep the momentum going, but as often as not, it turns into 10 or 15. And so it just sort of keeps the habit going. And I've found that very helpful.
Yeah, I've done a similar twist on the interval stuff I was talking about, just the number of days a week, but sometimes, you know, I'll start with 10 minutes two times a week. The next week I'll do 15, you know, the kind of working your way up the minute scale too can be helpful, I've found too. And with my practice right now, especially with my daughter, my time will shift from 10 minutes. Sometimes I get 25, and literally it's by the day. It totally depends on when she gets up and what mood she's in. So to kind of piggyback off what Tigan's saying, my first thought was like, oh, well, this isn't going to work because I can't get a consistent amount of time. And then I was like, well, I'll just see what I can do. And some days it's like, it seems like really rushed, and some days it seems really good, but it's the consistency that I find is really helpful for me. So.